Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello once again, and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with the program that helps you learn American English. We do this by telling you interesting stories using words that are easy to understand. We also speak a little slower than normal. Today, our program is all about food. First, we ask, is it safe to eat food grown near a nuclear accident in Japan? Then we will visit a restaurant near Washington, D.C. that has food made like it was in olden times. And while you're eating, people put on a performance as if they were soldiers fighting with swords and knives. It sounds like a lot of fun. So if you're ready, let's get started. Thousands of delegates from around the world gathered recently in Northeast Japan for a United Nations conference on disaster relief. 4 years ago, the area was hit by a tsunami that caused damage to the Fukushima Nuclear Power Center. During the conference, local officials transported some of the delegates throughout Fukushima to show them how it is recovering. Officials also told the delegates that food from the area is safe. Christopher Jones Cruz reports.
Until the nuclear accident in 2011, the Fukushima area was well known and respected in Japan for the food its farmers grew and the seafood its fishermen caught. But since the disaster, many people think of Fukushima only as a place that suffers from nuclear contamination. Kazuhiro Watanabe grows strawberries. Because he uses glasshouses to grow the berries indoors, the crop is ready to eat, even in early spring. But he has had trouble selling his crop in recent seasons because he grows them in Fukushima. His farm is far away from the area's damaged nuclear power plant, but being linked to Fukushima has hurt him. He says he was in the middle of the strawberry growing season when the earthquake hit. He lost half of his customers. But Mr. Watanabe says his business is now slowly improving. He says the most recent studies show sales of produce from Fukushima are now about 70% to 80% of the sales of produce from other parts of Japan. He says people are slowly changing their mind about the safety of the area's food. At the Fukushima Agricultural Technology Center, workers put fish, chicken, and vegetables in radiation detectors made in the United States. All food from the area is tested for radiation. Officials say Japanese safety standards are 10 times stricter for levels of radioactive cesium than American or European standards. Katsumi Komaki is the manager of the technology center. He says the center has cooperated with such organizations as the International Atomic Energy Agency to learn how much radioactivity there is in rice and other food from the area. The delegates also visited a factory where workers make more than 3,000 school meals a day. Atsuko Kano is the spokesperson for the factory. She says the meals are tested for radiation. She says the factory puts the results of the radiation testing on the Fukushima City website. and she says every parent is given information about what is in the lunches. Officials in Fukushima are working hard to help the community return to normal. One of them is Mayumi Suzuki, who led the delegates through the area.
The image of Fukushima is not really good in the world, but this is my dream that I want to tell all the people what's really happening in Fukushima, and that's why I'm organizing such tour.
Independent monitoring from environmental groups has shown that some areas of the city have high radiation levels. But there has been no evidence that there is radiation in the area's crops and fish. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. European martial arts, unlike popular Asian martial arts, are not widely practiced and are unknown to most people. But a restaurant near Washington is the center of an effort to make the ancient fighting skill more popular. The restaurant combines a show of visual, culinary, and martial arts to bring medieval history to life. Suits of armor, sharp swords, and shields can be seen at the European Martial Arts Academy, or EMAA. The school is in Alexandria, Virginia. Grandmaster Thomas Booth is the owner of EMAA. He is introducing the martial arts to his new students. European fighters used these defense methods more than 700 years ago. In Thomas Booth's academy, students in the beginner class use plastic swords to learn. The students do not need to wear suits of armor. Mr. Booth corrects their fighting form and tells them about the history of sword play. Ashley Mills is a student at EMAA. She attends the class with her friend, Belle Bredehoft.
This is our second day here. It's been a lot of fun. It's been sort of something different.
Belle Bredehoft used to study the Korean martial art, Taekwondo.
The basic footwork and stuff is the same. It's just one, you're using your fist, and here I have a sword.
Okay.
The European Martial Arts Academy says it teaches the martial arts technique and discipline to make students confident. Thomas Booth also operates a restaurant in Old Town Alexandria. The restaurant gives students an opportunity to show what they have learned to the crowd eating and drinking there. Mr. Booth calls his students knights. Knight Albert and Knight Conan are two of the best. The two are wearing suits of armor for their sword duel. Albert moves smoothly and scores twice. Observers close to the action move back a little. Of course, the sword fighting is just a friendly competition. No blood is spilled. Restaurant visitors become the judges. Tammy and Chark have visited 5 times.
It's exciting. It's scary to hear the swords clank, you know, against each other because they're not taking it easy on each other. They're making noise, and we're loving it.
There's literally sparks flying off the swords when they're fighting. It's awesome.
Thomas Booth designed his restaurant to represent medieval times. Every weekend there is a dinner and show called Medieval Madness. Visitors can order food known to be loved by King Henry V of England. And the servers, along with the owner, put on a medieval-themed play. Mr. Booth combines all these elements to create an unusual event.
So what we've done is take a look at the culinary arts, the visual arts, the martial arts, the winemaking arts, the brewing arts, the performing arts, modern and ancient. We've joined them all together to make a tremendous package.
The 2-hour medieval madness ends with a storm of applause. Visitors leave feeling full and satisfied. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. If you're happy, I'm happy. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Doctors have been warning for years that secondhand smoke leads to many types of illness. However, many children around the world live in areas where adults regularly smoke. A journal called Annals of Family Medicine recently published an article calling for doctors to start treating children's contact with secondhand smoke as abuse. In that case, contact to secondhand smoke would be viewed much like physical abuse or neglect. The author of the article is a professor at University of North Carolina School of Medicine. Dr. Adam Goldstein says secondhand smoke causes many diseases in children. These diseases include asthma and pneumonia. He adds that no amount of secondhand smoke is safe. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention agree that secondhand smoke can cause serious health problems in children. They say that compared to children who grow up in homes without smokers, children with parents who smoke have smaller lungs and more illnesses. However, several organizations for smokers' rights in the U.S. say people have the right to smoke in their own homes. These same organizations say that many studies done on the effects of smoking on health, including studies on secondhand smoke, do not use good science. The article about secondhand smoke and children comes at the same time the World Health Organization is increasing calls to fight against tobacco companies. Dr. Margaret Chan is the Director General of the organization. She says she believes tobacco companies are trying to avoid and even weaken anti-tobacco laws. Speaking in March at the World Conference on Tobacco or Health in the United Arab Emirates, Dr. Chan warned the fight against tobacco companies is going to be difficult. But she added, "We should not give up until we make sure the tobacco industry goes out of business." Other leading public health researchers who spoke at the conference called for the sale of tobacco to end by 2040. A spokesperson for the Altria Group, which includes Philip Morris, the leading cigarette manufacturer in the U.S., did not want to comment on the issue. Those who want to see a tobacco-free world wrote about their ideas recently in the British medical journal The Lancet. They say they hope that in 30 years, only 5% of adults around the world will still smoke. The lead author of the article is Robert Beaglehole from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. Mr. Beaglehole said, "A world where tobacco is out of sight, out of mind, and out of fashion, yet not prohibited, is achievable in less than 3 decades from now." He says such a world will need the full commitment from governments, civil society, and international agencies. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History, in VOA Special English. There was one main issue in America's presidential election of 1916. That issue was war. Europe was in the middle of what is now remembered as World War I. It was the bloodiest conflict the world has ever known. Most Americans wanted no part of the struggle in Europe. They supported their country's official position, neutrality. This desire was the main reason President Woodrow Wilson won re-election. People gave Wilson their votes because they hoped he would continue to keep America out of the war. This week in our series, Larry West and Morris Joyce tell more about the presidency of Woodrow Wilson.
Like most Americans, Woodrow Wilson did not want war. He feared that entering the conflict would cost the United States many lives. Wilson read the reports from European battlefields. The news was unbelievably terrible. By the end of 1916, several million men had been killed, wounded, or captured. At the Battle of Verdun, French forces stopped a German attack. The cost was high on both sides. More than 700,000 soldiers were killed, wounded, or captured. The Battle of the Somme followed. Britain lost 60,000 men on the first day. By the time the battle was over, losses for both sides totaled more than a million. Germany also was at war on its eastern border with Russia. Losses on that battlefront, too, totaled more than a million men.
At the time of America's presidential election in 1916, Germany seemed to be winning the war. Its losses were terrible. But the losses of its enemies, the Allies, were even worse. German forces occupied much of northern France and almost all of Belgium. German and Austrian soldiers also held parts of Russia, Italy, Romania, and Serbia. Germany was winning on the battlefield. The Allies were winning at sea. A British blockade cut off almost all German trade with the rest of the world. Even food shipments were blocked. As a result, Germany faced mass starvation. It urgently needed to break the blockade and get food.
This situation finally forced Germany to make the decision that would bring the United States into the war. It decided to use its submarines to break the British blockade. The submarines would attack any ships that came near Britain or other parts of Europe. This included ships from neutral countries, like the United States. Earlier, Germany had made a promise to the United States. Its submarines would not attack civilian ships unless warning was given and the lives of those on the ships were saved. Now Germany was withdrawing that promise. It said unrestricted submarine warfare would begin immediately. German ruler Kaiser Wilhelm said, "If Wilson wants war, let him make it, and let him then have it."
President Wilson immediately broke diplomatic relations with Germany. He still hoped the two nations would not go to war. He left that decision to Germany. if German submarines sank American ships, Wilson would have no choice but to declare war. Most American shipping companies feared attack by German submarines. Throughout the early part of 1917, they kept their ships in home ports. They wanted protection. So, they asked for permission to arm their ships. At first, President Wilson refused to seek such permission from Congress. He did not want to do anything that might cause Germany to declare war. Then he received secret news from Britain. British agents had gotten a copy of a telegram from Germany's foreign minister to Germany's ambassador in Mexico. The telegram said Germany was planning hostile acts against the United States. Wilson acted quickly. He began putting guns and sailors on American trade ships.
It did not take long for the worst to happen. Within days, a German submarine sank an unarmed American ship, the Algonquin. Then three more American ships were sunk. Many lives were lost. President Wilson no longer had a choice between war and peace. There would be war. Wilson called a special session of Congress. Members of both the Senate and House of Representatives gathered in one room. They stood as the President walked quickly to the front. He stood silent for a moment before speaking. This is what he said.
Fully understanding the serious step I am taking, I advise that the Congress declare the recent acts of the German government to be, in fact, nothing less than war against the United States. It is a fearful thing to lead this great, peaceful people into war. But right is more precious than peace. And we will fight for the things which we have always carried nearest our hearts, for democracy, for the rights and liberties of small nations, and for the belief that a worldwide union of free people can bring peace and safety to all nations.
President Wilson's emotional speech brought tears to the eyes of many of the lawmakers. They felt the great seriousness of his request. Outside, crowds lined the street to cheer Wilson as he returned to the White House from the Capitol building. He sat in his car and shook his head sadly. "Think of what it is they are cheering," he said. "My message today was a message of death for our young men. How strange it seems they would cheer that." On April 6th, 1917, Congress approved a declaration of war against Germany.
The Allies, Britain, France, and Russia, welcomed American involvement. The war was going badly for them. It had been very costly in lives, money, and supplies. Allied shipping was suffering heavy losses from German submarine attacks. A British naval blockade had greatly reduced food shipments to Germany. Now, Britain itself faced dangerously low supplies of food. Allied representatives went to Washington to explain what the Allies needed. They needed supplies, especially food, immediately. They needed money to pay for the supplies. They needed ships to get the supplies from America to Europe. And they needed American soldiers.
President Wilson and Congress worked together to organize the United States for war. Congress gave Wilson new wartime powers. He soon formed a council to build ships, improve industrial production, and control national transportation. He formed an agricultural agency to increase food production and food exports. And he formed an information committee to build public support for the war. Wilson's efforts succeeded. The Allies quickly got the ships, supplies, and money they requested. Most important, they soon got American soldiers.
Allied military leaders said only about 500,000 troops were needed from the United States. But American officials decided to build a much larger army. Before long, large numbers of American soldiers were crossing the Atlantic Ocean. They would fight the Germans at the western battlefronts of Europe. The extra strength they gave the Allies would play a major part in helping defeat Germany. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Larry West and Morris Joyce. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.